This is The Legal Lounge from Lanyon Bowdler Solicitors, where you'll hear about many aspects of law in England and Wales with special guests, industry experts and local charities. Here's your host, Amanda Jones.
Solicitors Edward and Amy discuss the role of a trustee in a trust. They offer some practical advice, discuss the various types of trusts, and point out what you'd potentially be responsible for to ensure you go into it with your eyes wide open.
Hello, I'm Edward, and I'm joined again today by my colleague Amy. Hello, Amy.
Hello, Edward.
So it's nice to see you again. Nice to have another chat about things legal and private clientish. What have we got lined up this week?
Got a question today on trusts and the role of a trustee and what is to be involved.
So this comes from our groaning, overflowing postbag of queries. So yeah, weekly we get huge levels of correspondence in with questions that people want us to address on the podcast. So this one is actually, it's from Amanda, our esteemed colleague Amanda, and the question is, I've been asked to be a trustee of a trust for, let's say it's, you know, somebody else's grandchildren, and I suppose the question is, well, should I? What's involved? What am I getting myself in for? So we've got a few things that we'll have a look at there. I suppose sometimes people get appointed as a trustee under the terms of a will because they're appointed as an executor, and then they carry on being the trustee of a trust that's generated under the terms of a will. Sometimes, you know, somebody's creating a trust. It's what we call an inter vivos trust, a trust that you're creating during your lifetime. And you're looking for people to be a trustee of that trust, a co-trustee. And sometimes a trust has been running for some time already. One of the trustees gets to a point where they no longer want to be involved, or they die, or they want to retire. And the remaining trustees are looking for a replacement, aren't they? So let's say you're approached. Somebody says, we'd really like you to be a trustee. I suppose the first thing to consider is, I suppose you might be honoured that you're being asked, and you might feel some kind of moral obligation. But I think it's not just enough to feel that you should take it on because morally you feel obliged to it. You shouldn't just do it for the kind of the moral reason. You should do a bit of due diligence, and you should be asking a few questions, shouldn't you?
Yes.
If you're asked, should I take on this role as a trustee? I think the first thing to consider, and these are kind of practical things, they're not really legal. In fact, most of it isn't really legal. The first thing is, well, what am I getting myself in for? In terms of the commitment, how long a commitment is this going to be? So I suppose that depends on, let's say if it's a trust for somebody's grandchildren, well, how old are these grandchildren and what are the terms of the trust?
Yes, because normally they would run in that regard till the grandchildren reached a certain age.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, first of all, ask to see a copy of the governing instrument of the trust. So this might be a will, because it might be a trust that's arisen under a will. It might be one of those inter vivos trusts that we talked about, a bit of Latin. But, you know, the trust that's been created in somebody's lifetime, there will be a specific trust deed. What does it say about when the beneficiaries get their entitlement? It will have to be spelled out in the trust deed. It might be a bit difficult to discern it because they're not the easiest of documents always to read, even the ones that have been prepared in the last few years. It's quite a detailed document to get your head around and work your way through if you're not used to dealing with them. You might have beneficiaries who, like you said, there's an age qualification. They become entitled to their share of the fund at a particular age. It might be 18, it might be 21, it might be 25. There's sort of traditional ages, aren't they? It might be that there is no specific time when anybody becomes entitled. It might be a fully discretionary arrangement, and the trustees can actually say, well, you don't get your entitlement at any particular point. We determine when and if you get anything, whether that's capital or income. What are the terms of the trust? What does it actually say? If it's a trust to my grandchildren in equal shares, then if it doesn't say anything else, they're going to get it when they're 18, aren't they? And then you can see, well, how old are the grandchildren? So how long is my commitment going to be for? But if it's a fully discretionary trust and it's been going on for 10 years already, that's a bit of a different kettle of fish, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose with that one, also going back to the wording of the will, but they can run up to 125 years.
That's true. They could, yes. Again,
not that you'd be expected to.
No, you wouldn't generally expect it to run that long. That is true. But yeah, under present trust rules, you know, your standard trust could run for up to 125 years. And if it's a discretionary trust, there shouldn't be anything, well, if it's been prepared in the last few years, there shouldn't be anything preventing it from running that long, if that's really the objective of the person who set up the trust. Pay careful regard to that. Have a good drill around on that before you take things on, because you want to know how long you're in for. Is it going to be a couple of years, or is it potentially going to be for the rest of your for the rest of your days? If there's an element of discretion about the trust, is there a letter of wishes that accompanies this trust document? Because if it was the kind of discretionary arrangement that we were talking about, the chances are that there's some side letter that lays out the reasons behind it being a discretionary setup, and how the person who created the trust, the settlor or the testator, that's the technical term, how they envisaged the trustees exercising their discretion. So, you know, and why it was that they tied things up in this way.
Yes, you would expect that kind of guidance. You aren't just, normally you wouldn't just be given completely free range. It would be up to you to decide how the trust is to be distributed.
The kind of tax regime that governs the trust might make you consider whether you're going to take the trust on or not. You know, as a trustee, you know,
because you will be responsible then for submitting any tax returns.
Yeah, exactly. So you're not going to have to pay the tax yourself, because the trust is going to be responsible for bearing its own tax and paying its own tax. But, you know, you're going to have to be the person whose name is on a trust tax return. You're going to be registered as a trustee with the trust with the revenue, and you're going to be responsible for filing returns, etc., etc. Now, of course, you may well have appointed an agent, an accountant or a lawyer to deal with all of those sorts of things on your behalf, but you're still responsible for it. And the differing levels of the regimes that you get depending on the nature of the trust, again, it might make you stop and think, well, again, is this something that I'm going to take on? So a simple trust, like we said earlier, you know, that one to my grandchildren or to such of my grandchildren as survive me, and the last one is going to be 18 in a few years' time, is fairly standard territory, not too much compliance, a level of compliance, but that would be a bare trust. But, you know, the one where it's a fully discretionary arrangement, or even the kind of arrangement where it's a will that said to such of my grandchildren as survive me, this is the testator, what they're saying in their will, to such of my grandchildren as survive me and attain the age of 25, that's actually a very different beast to the one that just says to my grandchildren in equal shares. It may not sound like it, but it is. And it doesn't just depend upon the value of the fund or the size of the fund that you're dealing with, you know, just that subtle change, or what appears to be a subtle change in the wording, can completely change the nature of the regime from a taxation perspective that applies to the trust. So, you know, if you're somebody who doesn't really want to get involved in that kind of thing and would find that all a terrible burden, even if you've got people who are helping you actually deal with the day-to-day administration of the trust, then maybe this isn't for you. And maybe it's best to recognise that right at the start.
Yes, and if you've been appointed through a will, you may not actually be aware that you are a trustee.
Yeah, yeah.
And I suppose at that point you don't, and like we're kind of saying, you don't necessarily have to act, you could renounce as the trustee.
Yep, that's true. Yes, you could renounce as an executor, couldn't you, right at the start. Again, you have to be careful about that, because if you don't renounce as an executor of a will early enough, you could get yourself embroiled to an extent that you no longer can renounce probate, and then the ongoing function and role as a trustee, although it's very similar to being an executor, is once you've got to the end of the administration of the estate, it's sort of similar, but it's a different thing, isn't it?
Different hat.
Yeah, different hat, different regimes that apply to it. Sometimes kind of difficult to know exactly when one ends and when the other starts. But, you know, you may have the ability to retire as a trustee if you've been appointed as executor and trustee. It might be that if it's just not something that is for you on a long-term basis, it might be best to recognise that and make way for somebody else who can. Now, I should say, this is not just an advert for saying, oh, this can only be done by experts, this can only be done by lawyers, and only lawyers should be trustees and executors, and you shouldn't, you know, I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying, you have a look, do your due diligence before you take something on, because it might be more complicated, more time-consuming, even with agents involved, than you might initially expect.
And you might also just want to look at who your fellow attorneys are and the beneficiaries.
Trustees.
Sorry, yes. But also the beneficiaries and potentially how demanding they are.
Yes. Yeah, look at who your co-trustees are. Are they people... Right, firstly, are you a kind of business-like person who's able to administer things well? Again, if you're not, if that's not your forte, then maybe this isn't for you, okay? So then look at the other people who are the trustees. Are they people that you can get on with? Are they people that you'd be able to work well with? Are they business-like people? Do you think you'll be able to, in terms of if there are any powers or discretions that you've got as trustees, do you think you'll be able to work in a consensual way, reach agreement? I would imagine in most cases, the answer would be yes, but at least have a think about that. Because if you think, well, I couldn't work with that person, I don't think I actually get on with that person, or I don't think that they're a sort of business-like person, really. I question whether they've got the kind of common sense now to be involved in this on a long-term basis, then why put yourself into that kind of long-term trustee relationship with them? So yeah, absolutely, that's really key. You know, have a look at the present people who are involved in the administration of the trust, the lawyers who are involved in it, if there are any, the accountants who are involved in the administration of the trust, the investment, if there's an investment fund, you know, the people who manage the investment fund. Again, do you know anything about them? If so, what do you know about them? Do they look like people? Do you know them? Are the personalities involved people that you know? Have you heard about them, their reputation? Do they seem like people that you could work with, you could have a good relationship with? Have you had a meeting with one of them and thought, when you're doing your due diligence and thought, well, I don't think I could work with them. I think that would be quite a difficult relationship. If so, don't take it on would be the way I'd view that. But at least give it some consideration. Jumping back a little bit, one of the things that comes up with this is people often say, oh, well, let's say it's a will trust, okay, and they're executors of the will, or they're beneficiaries, you know, under the terms of the trust that the will's created. And they're saying, oh, well, you know, when is the trust created? So you're looking at the will, and the will have all the details relating to the trust within it. And, you know, maybe co-trustees or beneficiaries or maybe investment fund managers are saying, oh, well, you know, when do you create the trust? When do you create the trust instrument, the trust deed? Do we have to do anything to do that? And the answer to that would be that if it's a trust that's created under the will have all of the terms, won't it? And occasionally people kind of miss that. Occasionally, in my experience, investment managers sometimes miss that point as well, strange as it may seem. Or if you're dealing with a bank, you're trying to set up a trust bank account, they sometimes miss that point. It seems obvious to me, or it might seem obvious to us, but it might not seem obvious to a new trustee or some of the professionals who might be involved in or associated with administering the trust. So, yeah, so the will, if it's a will trust, the will is the governing instrument of the trust.
Even though it doesn't have the title trust.
Yeah, even though it doesn't have the title trust. And so even though you will still have to do things like, you know, register that trust with the revenue, potentially file trust tax returns, do all those kind of tax and compliance things. Yeah, no, that's absolutely the case. The will itself doesn't necessarily, well, it doesn't say trust, does it, on it? There'll be references to trust within the words within the will, but you might have to look hard to find the bits that you actually want to get to that actually say this is a summary of the terms of the trust. So, you know, as we said earlier, even with more modern drafting, it's not always easy, unless you're dealing with it on a day-to-day basis, to work out exactly what's going on with a trust. I mean, if you've got lots of legal experience, sometimes it's not even easy to work that out. So yeah, so think carefully before you're taking it on. We talked a bit about the relationship with the different advisors who might be involved in things. Have a think about that. You know, what kind of fund are we talking about? What is the trust fund? Is it a portfolio of properties? Is it, at the moment, cash? Is it an investment portfolio? Has it been going, an investment portfolio that's been going for some time? If it's a cash fund, where is it? And what is the plan for the cash fund? Again, depending on the nature of the trust, depending on the number of beneficiaries involved, depending on the values of what you're dealing with, will greatly determine what the policy procedure is going to be in terms of investment, an investment strategy and investment policy. And investment policies are good because you're meant to have an investment policy, aren't you? Under the Trustee Act 2000, trustees have a statutory duty of care imposed on them. And they are meant to consider all these things, and they're meant to have an investment policy, which implies that they are meant to consider the strategy of the management of the funds in the trust. So that's key. You know, what are we dealing with here? And if it's just money in a bank account, like I said earlier, what are we going to be doing with that? Has it been sitting in this bank account for a long time and nothing's happened with it? I don't think I'd be too keen on getting involved with that, actually, if it's been there for quite a long time, depending on the size and the nature of the trust. But all these things are relevant, aren't they?
Like I say, it depends on the size of the investment, because if the size of the trust fund, because if it's like £1,000 to each of my grandchildren, then that's a small amount of money.
Yeah, yeah.
Would not need as much investing as a larger pot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
also, like I say, if you're coming in as a trustee, you will be discharging the previous trustee of all their responsibilities and taking that on yourself.
Yeah.
So like you say, you need to do your due diligence before you take on that role.
Yeah, take on that responsibility. Yes, absolutely. There's all kinds of things that we could be talking about here that are covered by trust, aren't there? Could be the legacy of £1,000, like you said, that's sitting there waiting for this person to get to the age of 18. And the only reason they haven't got it yet is because they can't give a valid receipt until they get to the age of 18. But that's a different kettle of fish, isn't it, to the, I don't know, £300,000 legacy fund that is there for the benefit of, you know, this pool of grandchildren until they get to the age of 25. Where if that's just, you know, if you're kind of 15 years into the trust and it's been just sitting in a bank account for the last 15 years earning practically no interest at all until the last couple of years, I'd be very cagey about getting involved with that. But you know, it's something that needs a proper investment strategy. It needs advice from people who are skilled in trust investments. And that's not just every investment advisor or every independent financial advisor. You want somebody who knows what they're dealing with. And you've got to also consider, which I think is probably a fairly obvious point, that where you're approaching investment and you're looking at, you know, advice that you're being given, it's not your money that you're getting the advice for. It's the money of other, you know, you're the steward of the money, aren't you? So the risk that it can be exposed to is low to medium. What you want to do with your own money is your business, but you're the steward of investments and funds for other people. Therefore, it's a different kettle of fish to what you might choose for yourself. Well, maybe not necessarily, and maybe this is an obvious point, but you know, but again, something to consider before you take it on. And you know, again, if all this kind of stuff is just a big turnoff for you, investments, property, money, interest rates, investment strategy, growth of risk profiles, then you know, best not to get involved in the first place. Best to leave it to somebody else, probably. Here's another one, I suppose, or another question that people might have is, well, I'm taking on this role as a trustee for these grandchildren. And let's say there's this trust fund has an age contingency, which says they get it at the age of 25. And let's say we've still got, I don't know, 2 out of 5 grandchildren to reach the age of 25. Does that mean it's all locked away and they can't receive any benefit from it until they get to the age of 25? I know that they're going to university and they could do with a bit of assistance to supplement their provision and loans as students. Can we do anything to help them? So what can we do, if anything, there?
There's two parts to that question. With a trust fund, you have the income and you also have capital. So over the age of 18, they would be entitled to receive the income from the trust fund also, which could help towards university. But under the STEP provisions, the trustees are able to advance capital for educational purposes. Mm-hmm. So that would then be down to you as a trustee to determine whether you considered it for educational purposes. And you could then draw down some of the capital, which is different to the income, from the trust fund and give it to them at an earlier age.
Yeah, no, that's a fair summary. I think the income, it might depend on the precise terms of the trust. And it might even, you refer to the STEP provisions, so the sort of it's a bit technical this, but they're a sort of industry standard of the kind of terms and conditions you'd really want to have in any decent trust. So that's the Society of Trust and Estate Practitioners, and they have a set of standard terms. They've changed over the years, so it might depend upon which edition that you've got that might determine the level of capital that could be advanced or when the income entitlement might kick in. And or it might depend on what the will itself precisely says. But generally speaking, there is a power to advance a beneficiary's presumptive entitlement to them before they get to that qualifying age for the purposes of education and maintenance. And the STEP provisions will beef that up, you know, make it better, more flexible. But the statute, you know, allows you to do a certain amount as well. So again, it doesn't necessarily mean that everything's locked away until that magic day when they get to the age of 25. If it's an age 25 contingency thing, you can potentially do something for them if you think that's appropriate for the purposes of education or maintenance. Because that question comes up quite a bit. And that then would be something to think about in terms of the investment strategy. You know, if we've got this fund and we're eventually going to pay it out to these people when they get to this age, in the meantime, would we like to have some cash, some liquidity available? And at what stage do we think we will need that in order to provide for things like education, maintenance, that sort of thing? So all important considerations. And again, if all this stuff is just, I don't want to have anything to do with this kind of thing, it just doesn't grab me, any of this stuff, maybe don't get involved.
Because it could depend on your kind of beneficiary, because a beneficiary may be happy for it to sit there till they reach 25.
Yeah.
And you could have the other extreme where they're contacting you every week because they want money for something or
absolutely,
other.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I've you know, you do get this. I've had a trust recently where one of the beneficiaries got to their age contingency and they are very happy just to leave it where it is. And in fact, they want to leave it there beyond their age contingency, whereas the other beneficiary, it was, you know, they needed the cash and they wanted it and they wanted it there and then. So it depends on the needs, the desires of the beneficiaries. But if, you know, the other thing then is if there's an age contingency, let's say it's 25, although you might have the power to advance capital or income to this beneficiary, the beneficiary can't come to you and demand and say, as of right, I demand that you let me have this and I want it now. If there's an age contingency of 25, once they get to 25, then they can, but before then, they can't. So another thing, and this ties up with the, you know, how businesslike are you and how businesslike and easy to work with do you think are your co-trustees and advisors? Another thing that sort of spins off from that is, or question that comes up is, if we've got powers, if we've got discretions, so like this discretion to advance capital to a beneficiary before they get to their age entitlement, or maybe it's a discretionary trust. So it's all in the discretion of the trustees. Let's say there are three trustees already and I'm being invited to be the fourth trustee. If we've got these powers, we've got these discretions as trustees, do we all have to agree about all decisions and discretions? Or is it decision by majority? So what's the answer to that one?
All decisions have to be unanimous.
Yeah, all decisions would have to be unanimous. I mean, unless the trust has been set up specifically to say that decisions or certain decisions could be made by majority, unless you've specifically got that in there, and that's not the norm. If you haven't got that, all decisions have to be unanimous. So again, if you think you've got people where you're not going to be able to work with them or you're not going to be able to reach consensus with them, you have to question, you have to raise the question as to whether you would want to take on the responsibility. And then one of the final points really is to do with compliance. It sounds like I'm trying to put people off getting involved in this at all. I'm really not, but I think you want to go into it with your eyes wide open, don't you? So I'm taking a jaundiced view of they're not all the downsides, but they're just the intricacies and the kind of day-to-day difficulties or administrative implications of being involved in a trust. So the thing that's just getting more and more consuming and more complicated and more difficult is just general compliance relating to trust. So this will be financial money laundering regulations, really, that's what we're talking about, and trust registration with HMRC, which again is really has got to the point that it has because of money laundering, you know, international money laundering agreements and regulations. I've been doing this kind of stuff for about 20 odd years. It's just got more and more complicated, all this stuff. There's more and more layers to the compliance. So you might find as a trustee that the first thing that you confront if you take on the role as trustee is that the fund manager that's running the trust investments, you're asked by them to complete reams of forms and provide all types of ID verification and, you know, your entire genetic history. I'm exaggerating a bit, but they will want to know, you know, whether you're a UK citizen, whether you're a US citizen, you know, whether you're resident in this country, whether you've been resident in other countries, because these are all things that are relevant from a money laundering regulation compliance perspective. Again, there's a lot to get through there. And if you struggle with that sort of thing, even if you've got people helping you with it, it can be a real burden. And if you've got people kind of, you feel they're poking around and they're asking you an unreasonable level of questions, it's not because they suspect you of being a, you know, running a drugs cartel in Colombia. It's just, this is the way it is now in the 21st century. I mean, it's because there are people running cartels in Colombia, and because a trust structure like a corporate structure has the ability to be less transparent. So all of these, the trust registration and the reporting requirements, is all to do with not just looking at who are the legal owners of the assets that are held by the trust, that's the trustees, but also who benefits from this or who can benefit from it, and looking at, you know, that underlying beneficial ownership. So it becomes a more difficult operation opening or managing or changing the ownership of bank accounts and trust investments. And again, it's not because anybody suspects you of being a terrible person or doing terrible things. It's just, this is how it is in 21st century. But it creates extra layers of red tape and bureaucracy, and that's not for everybody.
And just because you've given that all to one institution, it doesn't mean that that's not enough. So like the institutions won't take our word for it. We still then need to produce it to the different institutions. So you are giving your ID, like, and going through all that, the money laundering requirements, to each separate institution.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not us trying to create extra work. It's what we're being told.
That's absolutely right. Yes, it's not lawyers or accountants or banks deliberately trying to be difficult. And sometimes these things can take a lot of time as well. So, you know, we were setting up a deposit account facility with a bank recently, and it was a pretty good rate of interest for a trust, but it took a long time to do. And it wasn't us being difficult, and it wasn't the intermediary who was sort of introducing the trust to the bank being difficult. It was just these layers that the bank needed to check off and deal with, layers of not just the legal ownership, but the beneficial ownership. You know, if you've got a trust, you might have, in this particular case, there was a trust where you've got a life tenant, so somebody who's entitled to the income, and when they've gone, who's entitled to the capital. So in that particular case, that bank, you know, wants to have the ID, not just for the trustees, but for the beneficiary who's entitled to the income. In that particular instance, fortunately, they weren't too interested in getting ID and doing due diligence on the people who will be entitled to the capital when that income beneficiary dies, because that's when they become entitled. But in another instance that I've come across, the capital beneficiaries of a trust who may not benefit from it for years because they're not resident in the UK, that bank will not open the trust bank account for them. And it's not because it thinks that they're terrible people or they're up to no good. It's just because they're running a business. The margins that they can make by offering that facility at that particular rate are eaten away by having to do extra compliance because of these people not being resident in the UK. So they just say, no, we're not interested. You'll have to go somewhere else if you can find that facility somewhere else. So it's complicated. And if you think it's difficult opening a bank account for yourself individually in the UK in 2024, if it's a trust, it's as difficult, but like as if you're doing it on stilts. Yeah, trust registration comes into that, but that's a process that you have to go through with the revenue. A few years ago, not every trust had to be registered, only a few, basically if they were taxable. Then the ante was upped a few years ago, but last couple of years, pretty much every trust, with only very, very limited exceptions, has to be registered with HMRC. It's an online process. It's really quite complicated to do. And it's even quite complicated once you've done it to kind of marry up, if you wanted to appoint an agent to deal with things for you, to marry yourself up with that. Not marry, that's, well, it's called a digital handshake. There's no actual wedding vows involved. So I'm just a bit obsessed with Married at First Sight at the moment, so I've clearly got that on the brain. But digital handshakes and that kind of thing, and it's not an easy process. We don't find it an easy process, and we deal with it on a day-to-day basis. There's that to consider. But coming back to a point that I made before, although you've got all these administrative tasks and all these discretions and powers, and you should carefully go through all this due diligence and consider whether or not you take on this role as a trustee, ultimately, these are all tasks that can be delegated to experts, can't they? They can assist you. Accountants can assist you. Lawyers can assist you. You're not in it on your own, you and your trustees, unless you really want to be in it on your own and you want to deal with everything yourself. You can get advice either just on an ongoing basis or when you need it. There are people out there who will help you. So I'm not saying just don't get involved at all. The message is just, be careful, do a bit of due diligence, and I hope that I've not painted too black a picture, and I've not been too negative, but the people will have found some of the stuff that we've been saying. I hope that they will find it useful.
And I think people would be like the moral obligation, and like you say, if they felt flattered, or especially if someone's passed away and it was a, then they might, beyond, without having this spelt out to them, may think, oh, well, I'll just go along with it. It's easier just to go along with it without realising the implications.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then you might just, yes, through flattery, that does happen. You get yourself embroiled in something and then you think, well, actually, I'd rather get out of this. And you find that you can't because you're not necessarily able to just retire as a trustee. Maybe your other trustee, you know, maybe if you did that, there would be only one trustee left and they're not, you know, it needs two trustees and they're not willing to let you go. Or you feel morally that you can't leave that person who'd be left as a sole trustee on their own. So once you're in it, you might be practically or morally stuck in it. I came to the recording this afternoon in a state of some distress and stress, but I feel that as we've discussed things, my stress has left me, and I think it's thanks to your calming and sensible influence. So thank you.
Thank you, Edward.
Thank you to Edward and Amy for sharing their expertise, yet more proof that lawyers don't bite. If you have a legal issue you'd like me to put to our team to cover in an upcoming episode, please let me know by visiting lblaw.co.uk/podcast. Thanks for listening. If you found the conversation useful, please remember to follow or subscribe on your app so you're notified of new releases when they come out every Monday. Speak to you next week.
That was The Legal Lounge from Lanyon Bowdler Solicitors. Visit lblaw.co.uk/podcast for helpful resources, and please do follow or subscribe on your podcast app so you never miss an episode.